Hello, and welcome back to Lost in Citations, our regular podcast where we speak to the producers of interesting content and see if we can learn a little bit more about their background. Joining us today is Owen Jordan, who is the director of the International Education Institute at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Very nice to speak to you today, Owen.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
So a little bit of background based on what we have done in the past. We both worked at Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University back in the day, but we have separated and gone our own ways. Just a quick update on how is the job treating you there in Scotland?
The job that I'm doing in Scotland at St. Andrews is great. So I've been in St. Andrews since 2018. Initially, I was the director of a part of the university called English Language Teaching, and then we changed the name of that to the International Education Institute a few years ago just to better reflect the range of activities that we were doing. But it's good. Life is good. Brings new challenges every day. Stimulating environment. A little less rain would be nice, but generally good.
Just to give a little bit of context to our interview, this is the second time that I'm actually interviewing someone face-to-face. Owen has been nice enough to join me for what I'm calling the lunchtime series. So we've had a very nice lunch together, and we are now discussing his work. The paper that we're discussing is A Hollywood English Pronunciation for Japanese Students, An Exploration of Japanese University Students' Attitudes Towards Japanese English Pronunciation. Now, my first question in relation to this is that pronunciation is not often covered in world Englishes because it's quite difficult to investigate. Where did you get the idea for this paper?
Sure, thanks for the question. And I think it's probably worth saying as well, this is a paper that I wrote some time ago. In fact, when we were both working at Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University, and I was living in Japan. And so a lot of the sort of motivation for the paper came from that context that I was working in. So part of my role at the university was setting up overseas English immersion programs, sending groups of students to universities in places like the US and the UK and elsewhere as well. And I suppose I had noted that the students we would send were sometimes very reticent to speak, and that somehow I had a sense that, you know, based on my own professional practice, is the sort of nervousness about pronouncing things correctly one factor, not the only factor, but one factor that's sort of feeding into reticence to actually try to communicate, even, you know, when students were sort of placed in an English language environment in a country like the US, for example. So that was an initial kind of thinking point for me. The other bit of background is that this was something that I did as part of a research methods module on my distance learning master's program that I was doing at the time. And it's something I was keen to talk to you about now as well, because I now supervise students and we run master's programs in TESOL and international education at St. Andrews. And one of the things I'm encouraging my supervisees, other students to do, is to think about how they can consider publishing some of their work. You know, to not just think of each assignment as being just an assignment that they'll do. It will be read by whoever marks it, and then, you know, that it won't go further than that. So there's, for me, part of this sort of the structure of the paper was definitely influenced by the fact this was a research methods module, and this was kind of fulfilling the quantitative part of that. So this is a very quantitative kind of study that I've done.
Well, on that point, when you decided that it was going to be, you know, related to the possibility of student reticence, could you give a little bit more information about your experience with students on that that made you think that students would be more reticent to speak than perhaps student populations that had been studied in the past?
Sure. I think in terms of my own personal experience and why that sort of came to me as something that I thought would be important, that was based partly on teaching in a high school as well in Japan and observing that students generally were sort of reluctant to speak if they felt they couldn't speak well. And by well, they would often indicate that would be like a native speaker and that would be something that would be very cool to sound like a native speaker. So, and I think, I was in the school as a native speaking English teacher. And so this perception of native sounding English as being cool had a kind of other side of a coin to being that if you don't sound like that, then is that not particularly attractive or not desirable, and therefore something that maybe students don't want to do. And that was something I think that carried through from the high school I worked at to also the university as well, in terms of when students were thinking about studying abroad.
We personally have discussed the idea of standard English. But at the time of writing, I mean, the paper that we're talking about was published in 2010. Did you have an opinion of what was a standard that if you were in the classroom that you would be recommending the students to work towards? And is this something that you've maintained or changed over the last 10 years?
Yeah, I think that if I rewind back to the start of my teaching career in Japan, which was probably 8 or so years before I wrote that paper, I also wanted to study Japanese when I moved to Japan. And I thought my goal was to sound like a native speaker. And I thought as a teacher in the school that therefore also my goal should be to try and, you know, help my students to sound like a native speaker as well. So, and in my case, I'm from England, grew up in England. And so that was the sort of native speaker variety of English that I thought was standard and that I would try to teach them. Now, by the time I had written this paper, I was midway through a master's program, which had been sort of transformative or a catalyst for changing my thinking about some of these things. So at the time I wrote the paper, the thought had already occurred to me that actually, what is the standard of standard English? Now, I know some authors, was it Trudgebridge? I've forgotten.
Trudgill, maybe.
Trudgill, sorry. And Hannah would talk about it just being about grammar. But certainly, you know, I think for me, by the time I wrote this paper, I was thinking about the legitimacy of all sorts of different varieties of English. You know, World English is sort of based on the three circles model from Kakeru, of all of these being potentially legitimate forms of English, and therefore that there isn't one particular core, you know, variety that would be standard. So that there are many standards that could be used. So that was my thinking, I think, at the point that I wrote that paper. In terms of, you know, for a teacher or for an assessor as well, that could be tricky to work with. I was sort of inspired, I think, at the time a bit by Jennifer Jenkins' Lingua Franca Core. You know, some of the, when it comes to pronunciation, some of the features that she claimed would be sort of necessary for intelligibility. So things like the fact that the th and the sounds can easily be substituted was one of those features. So that was one area I think I was interested in as being a sort of standard, or at least the starting point for a set of standards for pronunciation anyway.
Well, we have spoken to Professor Jenkins at Citation 14 and also Aya Matsuda, Citation 12, in relation to the idea that what we want to have is a more inclusive variety, acceptance of varieties of English, without considering it to be just openly inclusive where it's not relevant. I think before we go any further in this interview, I'd like to ask you about the methods and the findings of your study. Just to say that it was back in 2010, and we've moved on since then. But I thought that it was an important artifact in the development of world Englishes and global Englishes of what you decided to investigate and what you found.
Sure. To be honest, before doing this interview, I read back through the paper again, and it was interesting to read back and sort of reflect on the sort of methods and methodology side of things as well. So as I'd mentioned earlier, this is a paper that was done as part of a kind of quantitative part of a research methods course. So it is a quantitative study. The module was actually run by Zoltán Dornier, Professor Zoltán Dornier.
I have heard of him, yeah.
Yes. So
God rest his soul.
Yes. And I think that you can see in the method that it's a very, very much a questionnaire study that kind of follows his research methods textbook, really, in how to do a questionnaire study. So it's based on multi-item scales, identifying some different traits, which in this case were the attractiveness, achievability, and comprehensibility of different varieties of world Englishes. So if I just sort of step back a bit and say that those three varieties were representatives of Japanese English pronunciation, British English pronunciation, American English pronunciation. The representatives were videos of Ken Watanabe talking, Hugh Grant talking as the British representative, and then Tom Cruise talking as the sort of American English representative. So students watched these videos and then they answered a selection of questions that had been through a sort of piloting process to identify, you know, with slightly different worded questions, the extent to which they felt that the pronunciations they could hear for each of these three people were attractive, comprehensible, and achievable for themselves as well. And the participants in the study were a range of students at Ritsumeikan and Asia Pacific University, ranging from the introductory English course level to the intermediate one. So generally not advanced students, so more at the kind of lower or beginner sort of end of the spectrum. And they completed this questionnaire on a sort of voluntary basis. So, I mean, that's really the fundamentals of the methodology.
So in relation to that, you say that this is for the to complete a certain course in your MA. Mm-hmm. While preparing this task, did you have any thoughts in mind? Did you have anything that you thought was going to be a finding, or was it just to practice this method of data collection?
So I didn't have to use this particular method of data collection. And I think I started this project with it in mind that this is something that I could share that could be impactful beyond just this module. So, however, a questionnaire study seemed like a good way to investigate this particular topic of different perceptions of world English varieties of pronunciation. So, I mean, that was really the starting point to it. I think I said it, I found it quite interesting looking back at this. I suppose I've moved away from a lot of the idea of sort of looking at statistical significance testing as a way to generalize to a wider population. That makes a lot of assumptions about whether anything really can be generalized across quite broad contexts, right, like across Japan, for example. I don't think I would really agree that you can make those sort of generalizations anyway. Of course, it's hedged in this paper, given that the sample size isn't that large. But certainly, I've sort of presented this as though a generalizable result would be an ideal goal, whereas I don't think that's really how the world works now. And I think if I was doing this again, I'd probably be much more interested in doing interviews with a smaller number of students to find out, you know, their perceptions. The other interesting things, just if I go back to sort of look at the methods here, is that the sort of ethics approval processes that exist now are different to what they were back then. And I think there was, you know, all students participated voluntarily. And there was approval sought to do the research. But I think that to do that sort of study again now, I would be providing a lot more paperwork to students about exactly what will happen in the study and that kind of thing too. So that's one of the difference. And the other interesting thing was I asked them, are you male or female? I think there would be another option on that now. But back in 2009...
Declined to...
Yes, exactly. So... Or, you know, giving people an option to identify in different ways to that too. Yeah.
So in your conclusion, you mention the phrase pronunciation role models. And you have obviously highlighted there are pronunciation role models in the materials that the students have been looking at. So Watanabe Ken or Hugh Grant or Tom Cruise. Oftentimes, these are set by the syllabus or the textbook or by the teacher themselves. Do you think that we should be allowing the students to make these decisions for themselves if that is the goal that they're aiming for?
Sure. I mean, I think students probably do just identify their own role models for things like pronunciation and all sorts of other things in their lives outside of whatever they're directed to in their textbooks and teaching materials. However, I mean, the findings for this study were that the students found Hugh Grant and Tom Cruise's pronunciation much more attractive than Ken Watanabe's pronunciation. And I should note as well that all of the participants were Japanese students in this case, although they recognized, I think, that Ken Watanabe's pronunciation was more achievable. But there was an issue there about it not being attractive. So therefore, if they were left to choose their own role model, would they choose one that is actually achievable for themselves? So I think as a teacher, and as an educator, I guess more generally, trying to direct students towards role models that are going to be useful in terms of being setting sort of achievable future goals for themselves in terms of pronunciation would be good, rather than just sort of allowing students to make their own choices without any guidance. So definitely the sort of agency of choosing your own role model sounds good, but I would wonder if a sensible approach is more like, you know, here are some parameters. So it should be somebody who, for example, speaks the same first language as you and communicates in the sphere of maybe politics, or maybe it's, you know, popular media or something using English, and that maybe that would be a good place to start.
Well, you bring up the word agency, and this is something that I try to drill down on with students in my classroom. And that's why I asked the question about whether they should be able to set their own goals. By selecting those three options in terms of their availability, in terms of their accessibility, in terms of something that was attractive or achievable to them, how did you make that decision?
So I think the initial interest was about Japanese English pronunciation. And there's some research that had been done about going back, I think, initially to intelligibility research done by Larry Smith. And Derwing and Monroe had done some stuff about accents as well, and that combined with the kind of World English's English as a Lingua Franca research made me think about the legitimacy of Japanese English. But then the question for me was, how legitimate is it in the eyes of the students?
And in your selection, that Ken Watanabe was a good example of in Hollywood, you know, movies. The best example that was available at the time in 2009, 2010.
Exactly. So for the research study, I wanted to choose sort of three exemplars that were somewhat comparable. Mm. And so that was partly the videos that they appeared in, you know, similar-ish length and audio volume and so on. But also the three people I chose were all male actors who appeared in Hollywood films and similar age as well. So it was trying to control some of those variables. It wasn't that I started off with this, you know, I didn't start with Ken Watanabe as a role model, as that being the idea in mind. It was more about Japanese English pronunciation. Who could I find who would exemplify that in a way that I can make comparisons?
And if you go back and read this paper, and I recommend that you do, Owen really does control for that at the length of time speaking, the number of words spoken, the topic that's being spoken of, and also the people who are speaking. So these are all control factors that I recommend that you take a look at, because it is in and of itself a very well organized paper. In relation to the people who are actually speaking, just to go back to the question, but just to get your opinion on it, do you think that students should be allowed to select their own role model for whom they speak? And then if their teacher or the person who is giving them a grade says, well, this is not the role model you should be speaking for, is it something that the student should be selecting, or do you think it's better that the teacher or the syllabus or the course selects that role model for them?
I think that's a really good question, because I think in the end, agency is incredibly important, and ultimately the classes, the English classes, let's say, that a student takes is only one part of their life, and that's only one part of their English learning life as well. So regardless of what they're being told in class, they will form sort of role models and take them on anyway. So that's, I think, to be encouraged. But I think I wouldn't recommend that any teacher sort of negates and tells someone, no, you can't have this person as a role model, or that's not appropriate. But creating an environment that guides students towards role models that are going to be appropriate for the goal of being a pronunciation role model is something that could be done. And that could be done through kind of curating some examples. In fact, I was thinking before this interview, you know, who else could be pulled out? And I was thinking of a female example could be perhaps someone like Kondo Marie, who, you know, appears on TV shows worldwide, speaking in English about tidying things up. But also politicians, you know, there's lots of different options there that could be sort of selected as possibilities.
So if a student came to you and said, I really don't know who my role model could be, would you recommend that it would be yourself as a as a teacher to the student? Or do you think that they should look at people who are successful in media?
I would think if they're interested in media, then media would be the right area to look at. If they're interested in politics, if they're a politics student, then maybe politics might be, politicians might be someone to look at. I would think that if it was me and I had a bunch of Japanese students who I was teaching, and it would concern me slightly if they were saying, oh, I want to speak like a native speaker like you, especially if they're university students and they weren't already able to do that. There is sort of fairly good evidence that many of them, not all, but many of them might struggle to take on this sort of completely different phonology at that stage of life.
Let's move on a little bit to your other work. You're in Japan right now because you are well, obviously, your family is meeting with other members of their family, but you presented recently at JALT on a topic of having a linguistic toolkit, I think is what you referenced it as?
Yes. So the JALT for Quokka presentation I gave, it was introducing what I've called a conceptual toolkit for language teaching practitioners, which is a collaborative output. It's hosted on a University of St. Andrews WordPress site, and it's basically five audio-only deep dive kind of conversations into five concepts that are myself and the other people involved, and primarily the other sort of main participant in this was Dr. Ahmar Mahboob from University of Sydney.
I've heard of him.
Heard of him, also known as Sunny Boy, also known as Prof. Nomad,
yes,
so you might
yes.
know of one of those names. But after some discussion, as he was visiting us in St. Andrews, we picked out these five concepts that don't, to the best of our knowledge, always get a lot of attention in kind of initial teacher education courses, like, for example, for English teaching, a CELTA or equivalent sort of.
So in topic. Your conversations with him, did you get the opportunity to speak at all?
Yes, we did. Actually, the recordings are very long, so each concept is sort of an hour and a half to 2 hours. And there's a panel for each of the concepts,
right?
Which is made up of a sort of mix of scholarly research and practitioner expertise. And really, the target audience for this resource is teaching practitioners, again, perhaps who are want to use this as a professional development resource and want to look at their practice through a different lens. So, for example, the first concept is language. What is it? How can a sort of deeper understanding of what language is, or questioning of what language actually is, how might that sort of influence how we actually practice that? And there's some things about, you know, whether writing and reading and writing are actually really core parts of language, or there's something different. I won't go into all of the different aspects of the sort of 1.5 to 2 hour discussion for each concept, but each recording ends with some points for practitioners to consider and take on board that they might use that to kind of influence how they approach teaching, or at least how they look at their practice and take that forward.
And how much did this change how you presented the material in the classroom? So obviously taking on board, you know, experts' views, but also you have to create your own syllabi for the courses. How much did this affect it? And what extra things did you bring on board from, you know, external recommendation?
Sure. So, I mean, full disclosure from me is that the teaching I do at the moment is mainly supervising master's and doctoral students who are themselves teachers or aspiring teachers. But within the International Education Institute, we do quite a lot of language teaching, mainly English for academic purposes teaching, but also we have sort of extension language classes in a variety of other languages too. I think in particular, let's take the example of the language discussion. So one of the points about language was, you know, there's a way of thinking about language which Prof. Nomad would advocate for, which is think of it as boli, which is a general sort of form of communication, and that these are not countable nouns, language is an ability. And when you think of things like that, the sort of barriers between languages break down. You know, that it's not as though there's English and there's Japanese and there's Spanish or there's Chinese. It's all language. And I think there's a way of looking at that that can be motivating for students who are often put in on English language courses in a sort of deficit model type situation. So for example, students coming to study in the UK, they want to do a master's program, but haven't quite achieved the language test score they need, like IELTS score they need. They might need to take a pre-sessional course because they're on that course because they have a perceived deficit.
Mm.
So how can we counteract this sort of negative sort of perception in a course? And one way would be just trying to raise awareness about the linguistic resource that students already have, and also allow them to use that in the classroom. So one of the topics we touched on was about translanguaging, and yes. This is something that staff in the International Education Institute have brought into their teaching over the past few years, much more encouragement of students to use their first language or other language as they wish in an inclusive way, you know, not in a way that might alienate any one or two members of a class, but using that as a resource to help learning the target language. So that's certainly one way in which those discussions have influenced practitioners within the Institute. Some of that change was sort of already in motion, but it's sort of, I think, strengthened that further.
Yeah, it's certainly something that I spoke with. But when I spoke with Prof Nomad all the way back in 2020, this is something that he was bringing up early and often. The idea that the language should be there for, it's a language resource. It's a tool. It's not necessarily something that you aim for a goal, or you aim for to sound like someone who's from the UK or from Australia or from anywhere else. But it's something that you use when it's convenient for you. And I do remember very well speaking with Dr. Mahbub for hours. The entire interview, I think, is about 90 minutes, but the complete interview was probably about 3 hours, because it kept cutting in and out, because he was out in the outback, yeah, and he kept accusing me of being the one that had the bad internet connection. But it was a very, very interesting connection that we had with him. But just to bring up, I'm showing Owen now the interview keywords from the interview that I had with him, and he was talking about the idea of semiotics and symbols that's very important to him. So in terms of what you do with the language, is that something that you prioritize in your classroom, that the students, even if they can't say exactly what they want to say at the time of speaking, that there are other avenues for them to communicate? Do you facilitate those types of teaching?
So again, I can't speak for myself particularly, but in terms of other staff in the Institute, certainly communication being the key point here, that translanguaging is an approach if a student doesn't know how to say something in English and present it, that they would perhaps use their first or other language that maybe would help. If they can use that to help them find out how to say it, that's something that they would be encouraged to do. You know, again, I'm just speaking here really about examples that I've either observed or teachers have relayed to me. I can't guarantee that's happening in every single classroom across the Institute, but that is certainly a kind of, that's an approach, if you like, that has picked up some momentum there.
Is that something that you look at when you're hiring people for your university, that you look for people who have this open-mindedness when it comes in relation to translanguaging, or, you know, trying to get them to understand that people from different language backgrounds might need a little bit more leeway in the classroom to allow them to communicate better?
Sure. I mean, actually, I think probably our interview process doesn't focus specifically on translanguaging or that topic. And often we're recruiting people who we may want to be doing some English for academic purposes teaching. And there is, of course, you know, there are other things like immigration requirements and requirements for writing and so on that we need to focus on as well, but also who may be able to contribute to our kind of practitioner-focused master's programs too. So we probably wouldn't zone in on that particular area, but the point about being open-minded and rooting practice in scholarly knowledge, that is definitely something that we would look for through the interview process. And so, you know, I think if somebody is open-minded and reads up about sort of latest ideas in terms of language teaching and specifically English language teaching, then translanguaging would be something that they would be open to experimenting with.
And if they said no, if they said UK English is the way,
so
what would be your response to that?
It would be a question. So why is it the way? And, you know, again, context is everything here as well, because if I was recruiting someone to work at University of St. Andrews, you know, St. Andrews is a relatively small university. It doesn't have transnational overseas campuses. Generally, that will involve teaching people who've come to study in the UK. And there is definitely a place for local knowledge and local varieties of English, which could be more focused around Fife dialects, if you like, of English, rather than sort of received pronunciation or anything. But there is certainly a place for that.
Mm.
But that would need to sit alongside a recognition of the status of English internationally, that it is an international language, and that there are many varieties of English used around the world.
Well, how is your Fife accent these days? Like, have you been working on that? Is that something that you've been thinking about?
That was that Welsh, or was that?
No, it was my random Glasgow.
Okay, but, right. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, interestingly, actually, St. Andrews is in Fife, which, for those listening who are not sure what Fife is, it's known as the Kingdom of Fife, but it's one area of Scotland just south of Dundee, just north of Edinburgh. But St. Andrews itself is a very international kind of bubble within Fife. There's right. something like 140 nationalities represented in the 10,000 strong student body. And the town itself only has 15,000 people aside from those 10,000 students. So it's a very international place where I think people there are, of course, people who have grown up in St. Andrews in Fife, but there's also people from all over the world who are communicating with each other in English and other languages in the town too.
And so the paper that we've been talking about today came out 13 years ago.
Sure.
In your research since, or your experience since, have you changed any of your opinions, or have you, maybe a better way to ask it would be, do you have more questions based on your experience that you would like to investigate in the future?
Yes, I think probably more questions overall, but I think one key thing definitely is less about the topic and more about the methodology, that the actual paper that we're talking about was very much rooted in a kind of quantitative paradigm, a sort of post-positivist, if you will, sort of paradigm that assumes that there are these generalizable rules that you can kind of somehow tap into and maybe understand the world through that. I think from having taught in and lived, in fact, lived and taught in a variety of contexts, so as a volunteer teacher in Canada, but then Japan in a variety of contexts, Hungary, China, now Scotland as well, I think context is everything. And I just feel very cynical about the idea that you can generalize across some quite radically different contexts. And even within a context, even when we think about Japan, the variety of learners that might exist and the variety of institutions, it's I think it's, for me, it's hard to see how you can really generalize across these wildly different environments with huge numbers of different variables as well that exist. So if I was to be looking at this sort of area again, I think I'd be much more inclined to focus on interviews and sort of qualitative research to really dig into why students think in a certain way. What is it that they find, for example, if they do find Tom Cruise and Hugh Grant's pronunciation attractive, why is that? What is it that's underlying that? Mm-hmm. Those are really interesting questions for me. But in terms of the actual topic and pronunciation role models, I think the idea of having role models for a student that they can relate to, that they can see themselves as a kind of future self of themselves, is something that I still think is quite important. I wouldn't think that my thinking around that has changed dramatically. The point you made about agency is very important. Maybe there's an impression in that paper that students should have a certain role model imposed on them. I certainly wouldn't think that now. But I do think there is a sort of importance in guiding students towards role models that will be achievable for them and meaningful in that sense.
Right. Now, to finish today, you are mainly in a coordinator's role today, less so in a teaching role, but also you are in a position to hire people and coordinate their thoughts. Maybe not the thoughts, but to...
I wish I could do that.
but to coordinate how they interact with students and direct them in this way. So basically my final question today is there anything that you would like new teachers of EFL and ESL to look at and read in order to make sure that not that you're changing their mind as teachers, because they are free to make their own decisions, but that they are, you know, better able to think open-mindedly about the role that they have as setting these guides for students. Is there anything you would like them to see or read, or is there anything that you would recommend?
Yes. So I think if somebody's starting out on a teaching journey, and whether they are or identify as, and I'm doing inverted commas here, but a native or non-native speaker of English or of any other language, if they're teaching another language, something that will encourage them to question that, the importance of native speaker role models, I think, would be important. I can't think of the reference offhand, but there is one which I've cited in that paper about the problematic, in the paper we're discussing today, on the problematic nature of native speaker as a kind of concept to be used for as a role model for teachers and for things like hiring decisions as well. And you can also read the TESOL International Association's position statement on, you know, the use of native speaker as a criteria for hiring as well. That's something that would be informative. So that's definitely one thing I would encourage people to look at. So the other thing would be just thinking about pronunciation specifically. Professor Jennifer Jenkins' Lingua Franca Core, which was published in 2000. I think that is something that would definitely be worth looking at in terms of giving some initial thoughts about what areas of pronunciation would be worth emphasizing and prioritizing, and perhaps looking at what is worth not spending time on. So, for example, the example I think we mentioned earlier about th and the sounds not being perhaps needed for intelligibility in a lot of English as a lingua franca context. So, you know, it's definitely not worth spending a lot of class time practicing these sounds. That could be time that's better spent on something else to enhance students' language abilities.
Completely agree with that. We've tried to call it up in real time, but I don't think we've quite got it.
Perhaps I can look it up and put it in the notes for the episode.
Okay, well, we will include that, and we'll include all of the things that we've discussed in today's episode in the notes for this episode itself. We've been speaking today with Owen Jordan, who is the director of the International
Education
Institute for the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And he has been kind enough to join me in my incredibly disheveled office for this interview. And we've been talking about the paper, A Hollywood English Pronunciation for Japanese Students, An Exploration of Japanese University Students' Attitudes Towards Japanese English Pronunciation. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today, Owen, and I hope we have the chance to speak again in the future.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to contact the show, the best place to find out about us is our website, lostincitations.com. Here you can learn more about the background to this project and how you can get involved. Our hope is to help academics, educators, and online content producers get in contact with each other. Our email address is lostincitations@gmail.com. We also have Facebook and LinkedIn pages. Please rate and comment on the sites you use to download your podcasts. It helps us reach more potential listeners. But probably the most helpful thing you can do is, if you like our content, recommend it to a friend and let them know what we're trying to do. Thank you very much.